Welcome to the Blessings Podcast, where we explore the twists and turns of life in all its perfect imperfection, so you can see how all kinds of other people are just like you. I am Mitzi Campbell, your life story mentor, a transformational teacher, lifelong educator, college professor, with decades of work in education, self-development, and psychology, nonprofit leadership, and the arts. I am a flower photographer, a yogi, a knitter, a voracious reader, and a mom of three fantastic grown-ups. And I'm so happy to be your host for this experience of connection, gratitude, blessings, and lessons. We are here to see firsthand that people of all walks of life go through things that are invisible on the outside, and that we just never know what our fellow humans are carrying with them on this crazy journey. So get comfy and let's listen with love, compassion, and an open mind as we ditch the small talk and go deep into discovering others so we can better get to know ourselves. Welcome back to Blessings, my friends. Today, I'm speaking with Heather K. Jones, a registered dietitian and wellness guide. Heather grew up in a household where food was something to be feared. Food was a thing to be engaged in a constant battle with. This established the foundation for Heather, and she set out to conquer food by studying nutrition. But the battle raged on despite her best efforts. She struggled with alcohol, drugs, and cigarettes. But the opposite of fear is love. And through self-love, she discovered it was more than just the food. There was a lot of inner child work to be done. And once she got real about the root causes of an unhealthy relationship with food and other substances, she found the keys to healing, happiness, and success. And she's here to share her story in the hope that it can help you or someone you love. Welcome, Heather.
Hello.
So good to have you here today. I just want to start out with a general question. What are you most curious about these days?
What am I most curious about? It's probably a thing I've been most curious about for the last 20 years, which is personal growth and how to use every experience in our lives to create more peace, more understanding, more compassion. I think that the soulful path and the heart-led path is what this world is crying out for. And those of us that feel called, I believe that when we do our own inner work and when we create inner peace and end the wars inside of us, that actually helps to end the wars outside of us. So learning how to grow in love and compassion in my own life and sharing that and sharing what has helped me the most.
Beautiful. I agree with you. I think once we learn how to achieve peace within ourselves as individuals, that really can blossom out into the whole world and might be able to change everything if we could achieve that.
Yes.
Oh my gosh. So let's go back to the beginning of your story. Can you tell us where you were born?
Washington, D.C. is where I was born and am raised.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so what did your family look like?
What did my family look like? I was one of three girls, the middle of three girls. And my mom and dad struggled. My dad had a lot of anger and he wasn't always that present. And my mother had a lot of anxiety and a lot of stress. And my dad struggled with his weight. He was 100+ pounds overweight. So a lot of our childhood, my mother was taking advice from the people she was seeing, trying to get my dad to lose weight, trying to get him to eat less. And so there were a lot of food restrictions in our house, a lot of fear around food, a lot of talk about how you need to diet and really be careful or you're going to end up like your dad. So there was a lot of fear, not just around food, but that was one of the things that was very present in my house at a young age. So it was like a lot of us. I didn't always feel safe and grounded. I was a really sensitive, intuitive child, and I didn't always feel that safe in my childhood home. So I struggled with my speech at a young age. I stuttered from a very young age. I was anxious from a very young age. I had a lot of struggles. My childhood was pretty, I wouldn't say it was the easiest childhood in the world, but it wasn't the worst.
Yeah. Do you have any stories about that come to mind about struggles early on?
I think just at a very young age, what I did, what I remember the most is that my mother, I felt like she was dealing with so many different things. She was trying to help my dad, and my dad wasn't always the easiest person to be around. My older sister had a lot of struggles as well. My younger sister required a lot of attention. And so I learned at a very young age, when you're in a household, I think unconsciously what we do is we try and figure out, where do I fit and how can I make sure that I'm getting my needs met? And so I became the one, I took on the role of, okay, if I help mom be less anxious, then maybe I'll get, even though I didn't understand that at the time, I understand it now. If I become the helper, the giver, the one who doesn't make any waves, doesn't make any more trouble than is already here. If I help my mom, if I'm the one who's always there to try and make her feel better, lighten the mood, or just be there to help her, then perhaps I will be able to get my needs met. So I took on that role at a pretty young age and felt very responsible to take care of my mom and very responsible to keep the peace. I was the one trying to create peace in a house where there wasn't always a lot of peace. So that's probably the role that I remember the most. And I think that was a lot of anxiety for someone at such a young age. And it's no wonder I started to struggle with my speech, because I was taking on a lot of responsibility at a very young age, trying to create a safe environment for me to feel like I could thrive and to feel like I could get my needs met.
When you say young age, what are you talking about? What age do you think when you started?
Very young. I remember I started to struggle with my speech when my sister Lori was brought home, and where my sisters and I are only a few years apart. So I was four when I started to struggle with my speech. But I can remember from a very young age, because my sister required a lot of help from my mom taking on that role, probably as early as three or four.
Wow. Do you remember having a stutter yourself?
I remember having trouble speaking for sure. And I remembered how upsetting it was for everybody when that came on, because my dad struggled with his speech as well. So I remember I was energetically picking up from my dad all of this. He was just so upset that I was having this same thing that he struggled with, I had as well. So I remember having a hard time speaking. I remember feeling frustrated by it. So yes.
That is really interesting. And it's so interesting that your father had the same struggles when he was young. Because yes. You couldn't have known that.
No, I think what happened when I look back now is I energetically imprinted that. And then when my anxiety started to raise, that's sort of how it manifested in my life. However he created that in his own life, I think I energetically, because I think we're energetically connected to everybody around us. So I imprinted that and then took that on again, I think unconsciously, as a way to get needs met, right? If I had this issue in my life, perhaps it was a way for me to get attention that I wasn't aware of, or it was a way for me to be heard if I wasn't being heard, right? Very unconscious. But as I look back now, because I've looked at it from a different angle now, because I always think, okay, if this is in my life, there's something I need to learn from this. There's something I need to grow from this. So when I started to do inner work about 20 years ago, I looked at the speech in my life and I said, okay, what is this trying to teach me, right? If I have this issue in my life. And 20 years ago, I didn't necessarily struggle with speech every single day, but the fear of not being able to speak was intense. The fear that that would come back, because I didn't struggle on a daily basis, but the fear of not being able to speak was still really strong. I looked at it, and what I discovered is that there was a part of me that had a really hard time, obviously, expressing myself, expressing my own needs. Part of me was trying to get an emotional need met, even though I didn't understand that at the time. So I started to meet those emotional needs for myself.
I have read things before about the idea that speech difficulties have to do with not being able to say what you want to say.
Yeah.
Or something along those lines.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. There's a book that I read that really changed my life 20 years ago, You Can Heal Your Life by Louise Hay. And she connects. I don't know if you know that book.
I was thinking about Louise Hay when I asked you that question. Yes.
And I'm trying to remember right now the exact, but she connects the different the different issues you have in your life and the possible underlying connection to that. And it did have to do with feelings of insecurity, lack of self-expression. And then there, I'm looking at it right now, not being allowed to cry, not being allowed to cry. And I was always trying so hard to be the one who is in a good mood, be the one who didn't cause any trouble for anybody else. So I would stuff down the things that I would feel in order to try and create less waves. So when I read that, and this is actually how I started to do the inner work and why I started to look at things at the emotional root, I was like, gosh, what was going on with me that I started to pick up the speech issues that my dad had? So not being allowed to cry. And at this point in my life, I was going through a tremendous amount of emotional healing and grief. And so I was crying a lot.
It's funny how that catches up with you, isn't it?
It is. And it's if you don't, at least in my own experience, if you don't choose to start to look at things and start to look at the challenges in your life through this soulful lens, then eventually life will create experiences for you that sort of, I don't want to say force, but allow you to look at things. Because life, I believe, is always trying to help us heal. And so it will bring you different experiences that will help you see what needs to be healed inside of you. And for me, I had spent years running away from my emotions, years running away from my fears, years putting on this mask of I am fine, and years of trying to pretend that all of this wasn't going on inside of me. And eventually it did catch up with me. And when I started doing inner work, I was having almost 15 panic attacks a day. My marriage had come to an end. I was literally on the verge of a nervous breakdown kind of thing. So it did catch up with me. And I feel synchronistically, this Louise Hay book came into my life at just the right time because I needed something to help me understand what was going on inside of me.
I'm just resonating so much with everything you're talking about in my own life. And also just, I believe exactly the same things. And Louise Hay has a way of sneaking up on you when you really need her. She does tend to come into your life at the right time. She did for me as well with a health issue. And it's making me wonder about a little bit about your mom. And I'm wondering if there's anything else in her experience that may have caught up to her with the anxiety. Did she ever experience any illness or any consequences of this life in this household?
Yeah, what's interesting is my mother had a lot of physical issues when I was growing up. She had a lot of back pain. She had a lot of hip pain. She had to get both of her hips replaced at one point. But growing up, she had a lot of back pain. So she was often not well. Back in the day, she would be doing traction in the hospital where they put you into a traction device in the hospital. And she wasn't very present and very there because she had all of these different health issues herself. And what's interesting is she read Louise Hay. She had the Louise Hay book, right? And so when Louise Hay kept showing up in that book, the way that I found You Can Heal Your Life is because there was a bookstore not far from where I was living at the time when I was going through this panic attacks. And I kept hearing this inner voice saying, go to the bookstore. So I'd go to the bookstore close to my house just to get out. And because at this point, I couldn't even leave my house very often because the panic attacks would come. But I would go to the bookstore and then inevitably this book, You Can Heal Your Life, would end up in my hand. And I had seen that book on my mom's nightstand. And I was like, there is no way I'm reading that book. No way. So my mom was starting to be on a journey of starting to explore and starting to look at these things. So she had heard of Louise Hay, but she just wasn't able to really connect those dots quite yet. And she's in a dementia home now. She's in a full-time memory care home.
Yeah. Wow. So I just see so many interesting parallels and just the things that you're talking about and how a person's life and their past and their generational wounds that come from their parents can manifest in their own lives. It's just really fascinating to think about that. So I want to just unpack a little bit more of your childhood. Can you go back and think about what's the very earliest memory you have?
The very earliest memory I have in my childhood home.
Yes.
Believe it or not, I was still in my crib. I was in a crib in the kitchen, and my older sister, who didn't want me in the house at this time, she was only a year above me, and she wasn't happy that I was there to take away mom's time or whatever that was. And so I remember her crawling into my crib, trying to cause me physical harm when I was a very young age.
Wow.
Yeah.
And what do you think that says about your life now or your relationship with your sister?
Anything? My sister and I actually have a really great relationship now.
Good.
Yeah. Cindy, we have a wonderful, she's a loving, caring, wonderful person, but I think we came into this life to heal and grow and learn. And at the time, this was just where she was at. So I had to learn from a very young age. I didn't always feel that safe, right? So it really started to create that sort of feeling of not being safe within myself at a very young age, which is definitely something I've learned how to heal in this lifetime. And the speech was a part of this as well. So she was just a beautiful piece of the puzzle that helped me to start the journey of how to become more empowered and how to create a feeling of safety in myself and in this world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How old do you think you were when you learned how to reframe situations in such a positive way?
I was 31. That's when I went through healing time. That's when I was going through divorce. I was having 15 panic attacks a day. This Louise Hay book kept showing up in my hands, along with a book by Iyana Van Sant called In the Meantime, which my sister, Cindy, she's the one who gave me that book because she had been through a difficult breakup herself. And those two books really helped me to start look within and started to look at my life through a different lens and started to look at my relationships through a different lens. And I really started to use all the struggles I had in my life, including my speech, my relationship with food, my relationship with others, and started to understand myself through a totally different point of view. So it was 31 and I'm 52 now.
Yeah, it's so interesting how it takes so long for us to be able to do that. But actually, I think 31 is pretty early. I know a lot of people that I work with who still haven't, even in their 50s, haven't done it. Yeah. And it's really, I think, a gift to at least have it available to you in your 30s and then be able to live forward from there.
Yeah, I think it's pretty, when I look back nowadays, 20 years, I've been on this path for a long time. I'm amazed YouTube and Instagram and social media, what wasn't around back then. And nobody was talking about this. Nobody that I knew was talking about this. So I was 31 doing this inner work and really felt like I was on a path by myself in some ways, because I had my books and I had myself, but I had nobody else who was on this kind of path. At 31, people in my world were interested in very different things. And it certainly wasn't inner work, healing, all of this. So it felt like a lonely path back then. But I think it also, because I teach and share what I learned through that experience, it was such a gift, because I really had to go within and learn how to listen to my higher self and get really in touch with that inner wisdom inside of me, because I didn't have a lot of mentors or people that I could look to help me on this path. So now I see it as a gift, but I am amazed when I look around now and I see the affirmations on the YouTube channels, because listening to affirmations was a big part of my path, learning how to reprogram my subconscious mind, learning how to support myself, how to treat myself with respect, and how to, you know, flow my focus in a way that was good for me. Like, all of that was what I did to help myself. And now I just see so many people out there sharing this kind of information in so many different modalities. And it's become much, much more mainstream than it was when I started on this path. So it's exciting to me to see where it's gone and to see how many people are opening up to this. I think there, and I always say, I have people in my programs between the ages of 21 and I think the oldest is like 87. And I always tell them, whatever age you are, if your heart, if your soul is calling you to do this kind of inner work, it is always the right time. Right now, right here is always the right time. I think that no matter what age you're called to this path, you have to trust that there's a divine plan and it's the right age for you right here, right now. I don't think there's any mistakes.
I agree. Yeah, I agree. Wow. I'm curious about your panic attacks. How old were you when you first started to experience them?
I had my first panic attack. I think I was 31.
Oh, okay.
My marriage had come to an rather abrupt end. And I was in probably the most self-destructive part of my life, where I was struggling with so many different things. And when that marriage came to an end, it's like all of that energy from all of the years of pushing down those emotions started to come up. And I just had so much that I needed to heal and look at, and so many emotions I needed to sit with and allow. And so it was at that time. So they started almost the instant that marriage came to an end was the instant that all the energy was finally allowed to show up. Yeah.
I started having panic attacks over the past year.
Okay.
And it was a direct result of a health challenge that came about because of some other stressors in my life. And I had never experienced a full-blown panic attack before. I know my mom had them, my son had them, my daughter had them, but I had never had one. And I think it's interesting to think about what it feels like to have a panic attack. For me, it felt like I describe it like somebody was putting on a lead X-ray apron over my whole body. Like it was a weight that just came into my whole body. And then of course there are feelings like that you're going to die, basically, is the worst feeling that I had when I was having this. I was like, what's happening to me? Am I going to die? Am I dying? And it's terrifying. So can you talk about what it felt like to you, if you feel safe doing that?
Yeah, of course.
To have a panic attack?
Of course. And it's so interesting because until you personally have a panic attack, you don't really appreciate what it's like to have a panic attack. You hear about other people having it. You have your son having it or other people having it. And you think you understand what that is. And you think you know what that is. But until you have one, you can't really understand it. But the fear of dying is what was so prevalent for me when they would come on, and I would become completely overwhelmed with a feeling of feeling extremely unsafe, feeling like something was very wrong, but I don't know what it is. I would have to stop wherever I was because it would just be so overwhelming to me. Like it would be like, I couldn't breathe. I couldn't see. I couldn't hear. It was like, being surrounded with the most terrifying fear you've ever had in your entire life. And it's the confusion that you don't know what's happening. Like the first couple of times you have one, like the fear and the confusion of what is going on. So that was the scariest thing for me at the time, was not understanding that it was a panic attack, because you think you're dying. You hear about people who go to the hospital because they're having a panic attack, and you're like, how bad can it be to have some anxiety? But no, you literally feel like you're dying. So it took me some time to be able to find emotional tools to be able to support myself and to be able to be the witness of the energy that was there was so helpful for me, right? Instead of just being lost in it, if I could take some deep breaths and be able to come back into a more present state and be able to breathe my way through it and be able to do some simple exercises like counting with my hands and that kind of thing. So helpful. If you can find just a sliver, if you can get yourself out of the panic and be able to remind yourself of the here and now, then I was able to walk myself through it. But it took some time. It took a lot of practices, a lot of inner work, and it took a lot of looking at what's going on inside of me and what do I need to meet with love? What do I need to see that I'm not willing, that I wasn't willing to see before? And there were just parts of me that were just sitting in so much pain. And I always say with people that I work with now, it's if that part of you is sitting in so much pain and you ignore it, it's you're saying you don't matter. These feelings don't matter. These emotions don't matter. This fear doesn't matter. I'm going to ignore you. And so when you have panic attacks, it's literally that is coming into your life, I believe, so that you can no longer ignore it, because you can't ignore a panic attack. Yeah. You can have regular anxiety. You can ignore a lot of different things, but you can't ignore a panic attack. It literally stops you in your tracks. And so it's like a huge wake-up call from the part inside of you that needs your love, needs your attention, needs you to be there and to help it, to help this part of you that is in so much pain.
Louise Hay is the first person that taught me about that idea of loving the parts of you that you want to be angry with. If you have an illness, you want to fight it. We have that tendency to fight it, or we're mad about it, or we're upset about it. But you have to do the opposite. You have to love it. And I learned about that from Louise Hay, and it makes a huge difference. I think with the panic attack, like for me, the biggest thing that I was able to do, because they weren't like that as prevalent in my life, they had just started, and I haven't had one now, thankfully, for quite some time, but was I would remind myself, okay, this is a panic attack now because you've had it happen and you've always survived it. You don't die from this. Like just logically reminding myself that I've survived every single one I've had so far. And something about that brought me back down to earth. And then you get through it. You use the tools that you have and breathing, meditation. I used a lot of binaural beats. I would just have to stop what I was doing, maybe put in some of those frequency music videos on YouTube. And
if I had those back then, I would have used them. Or 20 years ago, those things didn't exist.
I know. We really are so blessed to have all these tools now right at our fingertips.
Yeah. There's tapping, there's the binaural beats, there's so many different tools out there now that are so helpful. And whenever I feel anxiety coming on, like I'm much more aware now. And so it doesn't usually get to the level of panic attack. But when I feel anxiety coming on, using tools to help me meet that anxiety at an earlier stage will help it and keep it from going into that full-blown panic attack.
Yeah. Yeah. But so useful.
Finding yourself you're not going to die is a big one, right?
That is a big one. That's the biggest one for me.
No, it's okay. I'm not going to die. I'm actually safe in this moment. Right. And to look around the room and say, prove to yourself that you're safe, right? I'm safe. I'm safe. And look at what you hear. Remind yourself that you're safe in this moment.
Yeah. I do. I use that tool as well. I'll look at an object and say, oh, there are my books. Okay. There's my bathroom. I see my dog. I'm here now and I'm going to get through this. And you just have to keep talking to yourself. It's very hard, but man, it's crazy what a panic attack will do to you physically.
Yeah.
Wow.
Stop in your tracks.
It will.
It's
doing it for a reason. It's saying to you, stop and look at something that there's something you need to learn that you're not learning yet.
It's an incredible wake-up call, right? I'm so grateful for the panic attacks because it literally stopped me in my tracks. I had no choice but to stop. And I'm a pretty determined person and I had a lot of energy. And so I was really good at avoiding things. I was really good at plowing through. I was really good at putting on that mask and pretending everything was fine. So I needed the panic attacks to wake me up. I needed the panic attacks to say, you need to take care of yourself. You need to start going within and start looking after these parts of yourself and start to really start this inner path. So I'm so grateful for them now. But in the moment when you're having them, worst feeling in the world.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's a terrible thing. And very, like you said, very difficult to understand if you haven't actually experienced it. So this mask that you're talking about that you had been wearing, were you wearing it through your teenage years?
Yeah, I was wearing it. It was constantly on because I was trying so hard to cover up what was going on inside of me. I don't think I was conscious of it in my teenage years. I think that I was just doing the best I could to survive and to try to fit in. I always felt a little bit, I don't know what the word would be, like it just, I don't know, I didn't quite feel like I fit in. I didn't really know what I wanted to do this life always felt a little confusing to me is the best way to say it. So I felt like I was just trying to survive and my way to survive was just, I was partying at a pretty young age. I was distracting myself by going out and drinking and smoking and doing all these different things. But I don't think you would have seen that. I was having a hard time in high school. I definitely was barely passing my classes and this kind of thing. And I was at a Catholic all-girls school. And so the nuns were very worried about me. But I think it was a survival mask, right?
Yeah. What was high school like for you?
Going to an all-girls Catholic school, it was different. I never aligned with Catholic ideologies, so that never felt exactly right in my heart. I also was naturally rebellious against the rules that were placed on me, but quietly rebellious. I would I would sneak out in a really quiet way. I also had a wonderful group of girlfriends that I met there, and I'm still in touch with some of them. So there were really good things to it as well. And when I look back, probably the structure of that Catholic school was very good for me at the time. I didn't have a lot of parental input at that point. My dad just wasn't around very much, and my mom was sick all the time. It was a very good environment for me in many ways, but also a very confusing environment for me. I didn't understand all the rules. I didn't really understand. I wanted to feel more free.
Yeah. So you wanted to break out. After high school, what happened then?
I took some time off. I actually didn't go to college right away. I took some time off and I just worked and partied and had fun and just did my own thing. And then eventually I went back to college. And then I went back to college to study nutrition and health because I had a lot of fears that I was going to end up like my dad. Struggled with food and weight so much. And I struggled with food from a young age as well. I was restricting food and then binging on food and using cigarettes and coffee to suppress my appetite because I was convinced I was going to end up just like my dad. So I thought, all right, if I go get a nutrition and health degree, I will learn what I need to learn so I don't end up on the same path as my dad. So I went to college and I thought, once I learn more about nutrition and health, certainly I'll be a healthier person, but it wasn't like that. It's like the more I learned, the more dysfunctional my relationship with food became. Like it was such a interesting time because here I was learning about health and nutrition and how to nourish your body. And I had a completely dysfunctional relationship with food.
Pardon the interruption, friends, but I had to tell you something. I was recently on a call with Dr. Joe Vitale of The Secret, and he said something to me that will stick with me for the rest of my life. He said, "You have to let people know what you're doing because that's your part in the co-creation process. Letting people know what you're up to helps your people to align with you." So I wanted to give you an update about what's happening in my book club. The Blessins Personal Development Book Club community is growing and people are getting so much out of it. The feedback I've been getting about the takeaways and the tools that people are gathering from our current book, the first book, Mindset by Carol Dweck, is just feeding my soul. And I know it is my purpose to get the word out about this book club community because it is literally changing lives. If you love personal development books, and you understand the importance of engaging with books actively, doing the work, and interacting in a community of like-minded people around books that have the power to influence your life forever, then join us, because you are just in time for our next book. We will be starting the iconic classic book, Think and Grow Rich by Napoleon Hill on February 20th, 2024. So now is the time to get in so that you can get the book in your hands, find out what you need to do with it, and be ready to dig in before the 20th. So go to mitzicampbell.com/bookclub for more information. And to join, you deserve this. You deserve to do something wonderful for yourself. And it is my pleasure to bring all of the best of my work as a professor into personal development. I think it might be my superpower. Now, back to the show.
I think that happens a lot. There's actually a lot of women looking back now in my college days who also struggled with, you go into the thing that you struggle with the most. So there were a lot of people with dysfunctional relationships with food who were in that nutrition school with me at the time, although we didn't talk about it.
In your family, for example, when you had a holiday, what was the meal like? Was it like a traditional kind of happy atmosphere around the food, or was there tension around the food?
Oh, there is tension around the food. And my mom did not like to cook. So my sister Lori and I actually learned how to cook at a pretty young age because she didn't like to cook. But it was definitely tense. It was definitely, you know, my dad would bring foods in we weren't supposed to have. And my mom would be upset because those foods were there. And of course, my dad would be eating too much. And there was a lot of tension around all of that. And I wouldn't say it was like an open, fun experience. Although my sister and I love to cook. So we would always enjoy that part. my younger sister, Lori, and I love to cook, and she still loves to cook today. And I do as well, but a lot of tension for sure.
Yeah. What about the phrase comfort food? What does that bring to mind for you?
It's interesting because I watched my dad. He used food for comfort for sure. Ice cream bars, cinnamon rolls, candy. And this was a constant for him. And for me, I would restrict all of those foods. And then when I would get around those foods, it would be like, oh, I have to eat these because I'm never going to get these again.
Yeah.
So for me, it was like a restrict and then binge and then restrict and then binge. Whereas my dad, it was more of a constant comfort food, always eating to try and feel better.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think the idea of that we have a phrase calling food a comfort is really interesting. And it brings me back to a lot of things in my childhood. I have recently had to change a lot of things about the foods that I eat because of my health. And growing up, my go-to for everything was mac and cheese, macaroni and cheese. I ate macaroni and cheese at every holiday. And now that I'm in this place where I am looking at my food today, that's something I know that I can't eat right now. I'm not saying I'll never eat it again, but I can't eat it right now because dairy and gluten are two things I can't have right now while I'm in a healing phase from some things I've experienced. And it's really interesting to me because I miss the comfort of macaroni and cheese. I love macaroni and cheese. And it brings me back to every childhood holiday because I was such a picky eater that it was like the only thing I would eat at Thanksgiving, the only thing I'd eat at Christmas. And my grandmother would make me the box of the Kraft mac and cheese. Terrible, but well, I don't know.
I think that food is meant to be an enjoyable thing. Food is meant to be discomfort in some ways. And so I think it's a natural in some ways. The trouble is when we start to replace food for the comfort that we really long for. So what you're really long for, you're not longing for the food itself. What you're longing for is the feeling that you got when you ate the food, right? Mm-hmm. The feeling that you got was somebody making you the food. It was a feeling of being cared for. It was a feeling of, this makes me feel good. This makes me feel safe. This feels familiar to me. This feels good to me. So it's the feeling that you're looking for. Mm-hmm. So since you can't eat that food now, you might want to look at, okay, what was the feeling? What were the frequencies that I was going for? Mm-hmm. What would you say are the things that you were trying to feel? Safe?
Yeah, it's interesting. I would say comfortable. Because I didn't feel comfortable with some of the other foods that were being served. I don't know why. I didn't have very good eating habits as a child. And I'm not sure why that is. I definitely want to take a deeper look at that. But the other thing that's just coming to my mind was that when my grandmother had to make something special that was just for me, that's obviously very telling. I needed to have that special thing that was just for me. So it is really interesting. I'm going to definitely do some work on that.
You were looking for attention.
Yep, absolutely.
Would you get in trouble for being picky about the food? Or
they would say things to me, but nobody ever forced me to eat anything I didn't want to eat.
Okay. So you were looking for attention in a positive way. You were looking for someone to see you and to understand you because nobody was really maybe paying you the amount of attention and giving you the kind of care that you wanted or needed at that time, right?
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. If I got into a big family gathering and I got lost in the fray, maybe. That's possible.
Yeah, you didn't feel seen.
I didn't feel seen in that moment, probably. You're right. Very interesting. I'm going to do some work on that. I have thought about things in my childhood and the relationship to how I have, quote, turned out today because of them. And food isn't one that I've taken a deep look at. So I'm super interested to do that. What's something somebody could do who wants to go back and take a look at their relationship with food and how it was formed?
Yeah. And you don't have to go back, but I think it can be interesting to go back if you do it with a lightness and you do it in a desire to want to heal and to grow. Because I think our relationship with food is a reflection for our relationship with ourselves. Mm-hmm. So for you, for example, the times that you didn't feel seen in your family around food, maybe unconsciously, there's a part of you inside that said, okay, I'm going to be really picky about food because then maybe somebody will pay attention to me. It's an unconscious thing. Just see how that lands for you now. Does that feel like a possibility?
I don't know. I don't feel like I was ever not seen as a child. I feel, because I'm the oldest child, I feel like I was definitely the one that got more attention in a lot of ways. Now that you're bringing it up, it's interesting. So that could be something that was going on and I didn't realize. I don't remember it, but bringing it up is really interesting.
Yes. So you can just look at that and see if it gives you a feeling of aha or a feeling of, oh, interesting. Yeah. And then what I always do is try to bring it back into the now, right? Because that part of you that was, at least with your grandmother in the settings where there was a lot of people around, that part of you in that moment was wanting attention, wanting someone to make you something special for you, right? And giving you that comfort and the validation of being seen. So what can you get into a quiet space and you can actually just speak to that part of yourself now and find out what that part of yourself that's longing for the macaroni and cheese find out, just ask her, that part of you will actually speak to you if you go within and speak to that part of you and ask her what she needs right now. Mostly that part of you just wants to be seen, wants you to see her, wants you to speak to her, wants you to notice her and be there for her during this time where you can't eat macaroni and cheese, right? So it's like that part of you calling for attention. And if you give that part of you attention, you may find that the desire for macaroni and cheese naturally goes away because that part of you has what it needs. It has the attention, it has the love, it's being seen.
I love that. I'm definitely going to do that because it's an interesting thing to think about when you know that something that you're putting into your body isn't working for you at a certain time of your life and you have to not have that thing in your body. But why do you miss it so much? And I love that what you're saying makes so much sense because it's definitely beyond the food itself because it's just food. It's just something that is going to give me about my body fuel or not.
And that's also really interesting. It honors the part of you that feels disappointed about that. Feels like maybe you did something wrong and that's why this is happening with your body. Like it allows you to really be with and understand the part of you, see the part of you that feels disappointed and not make that wrong. See the part of you that feels a little frustrated by this experience that you're having with your body right now. So it allows you to get to the energetic root of these different things that have probably come up along your journey with health, leading to some of these panic attacks, and allows you to work with that energy in a really direct way and really meet those parts of you that feel disappointed without shaming them, allow you to meet the parts of you that want comfort, that want to be seen in a really direct way. And when you do that, you'll find that it really does help you get the clarity that you need in the journey that you're on. And so I find that kind of work of really meeting those parts of ourselves with a lot of compassion to be incredibly helpful. So don't make it wrong that you feel disappointed that you can't have it. Actually speak to that part of yourself and say, I hear you. Get into that higher self mode where you're the adult to this part of yourself that needs your care. Yeah. And you don't shame it for the disappointment. You allow it to be there. And when you do that, energy actually transmutes. But when you just make yourself wrong or just, oh, I can't have it. I shouldn't feel disappointed. It's not a big deal. It's just macaroni and cheese. Then all that energy just gets pushed down. But if you instead start to look at it from a different point of view, then it allows you to heal what's going on inside, which helps your body to heal, which helps you to get to a different point with all of this. So it's always about much more than food.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It is. And it's funny that I think I'm pretty good at doing that, but now that we're talking about it, I'm getting uncomfortable. I'm like, whoa, okay. I'm not really as good at this as I thought I was. And I think there's a lot more to look at here. So
well, don't shame yourself for that as well.
I know. I'm shaming myself.
Right. We're all doing the best that we can. And we need other people to mirror things back for us. We can't always easy to see with somebody else what's going on, but same as I'm able to mirror this back to you, there's things you'd be able to mirror back to me. We all need help and we all need to use each other as a beautiful mirror to see what we can't see. So we all have blind spots and that's why we have each other to be able to help each other see.
So true. I love that. Thank you. And I love that you brought up that when something happens in your life, especially an illness or a condition that you might have or symptoms that you're experiencing, that you shouldn't blame yourself or think that you've done something wrong to bring it on. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
100%. I believe that illness is a messenger, right? And it's helping you to heal and see parts of yourself that need attention, or to help you to see your health through a different point of view, or to help. It's always there, I believe, to help us. And even though illness is a difficult teacher, right? If we are shaming ourselves for that and making ourselves wrong for it, then we're going to miss the journey that we could go on through this to help us to grow and to help us to heal. So I think it's important to meet the parts of ourselves that are in shame, to directly meet those parts and to speak to those parts and to allow those parts to be there and to be there for those parts and to meet those parts on a daily basis, because I think that shame is huge. That was true for me when I started this journey, this inner work with food, because I had a nutrition degree. I was working at a nonprofit health group. I was supposed to be the one helping everybody else with food and health and to be this healthy kind of example in the world. And meanwhile, I had this horribly dysfunctional relationship with food, and I was binge drinking and doing drugs and like the opposite of a healthy person. So I had so much shame around all of that. And it wasn't until I started to meet this shame with open arms and allow the shame to be there that the shame started to dissolve, because I was willing to see it and I was willing to work with that. So again, it's just meeting the shame with open arms and saying you're allowed to be here. Mm. And there's a wonderful, I don't know if you know who Tara Brach is. Mm-mm. She's a meditation teacher who I started to work with years ago, and she has a beautiful process called RAIN, the acronym RAIN. And this is something that I use to meet these emotions with love. So I can walk through it now with you if you want.
Yes, let's do it.
Okay. So RAIN, I'll just talk through it. So the acronym RAIN, it's so easy because I just love the name, because I also love RAIN. I feel like it's a very comforting thing, but it's the RAIN of self-compassion. And the R in RAIN is just to recognize what's there. It's just to take that sacred pause and to recognize what's there, to recognize if there's shame there, to recognize if there's shame thoughts, to notice your body and to notice where the shame lives. If you start to really scan your body, you'll be able to feel where that shame is in your body. And just to recognize what's there, to be aware of what's there, the thoughts, the emotions, the feelings that are there. And that's the R of RAIN. And then the A of RAIN is to allow that to be there, to allow that to be there, to stop resisting that, to stop making that wrong. And I often will put my hands on my heart and say, there's a part of me that's in a lot of shame, and that's okay. It's okay that shame is here. Shame, you're welcome to be here. I welcome you here. You belong here. And it's just allowing the shame or the sadness or the disappointment or the fear or the anger, allowing whatever is there to be there. You stop resisting it and instead you open to it. And then the I in RAIN is to investigate, just to investigate with care. Now that you've allowed it to be there, what is this part of me believing right now, right? This part of me is believing that there's something wrong with me because I'm sick, or I've done something wrong, or my body has denied me in some way. Like you investigate with care what you're believing and what is there for you, right? With care, because now you've allowed it to be there. So you're in a more open, compassionate, curious place where you can actually hear the inner wisdom inside of you. And then the final step is N, which is to nurture. What does this part of me need the most right now? Does this part need acceptance? Does it need forgiveness? Does it just need me to be here? And again, it's an inner process, and you will start getting the answers to these questions, and you will start to know what it is you need as you walk yourself through the process, meeting the shame there with unconditional love, compassion, and be curious about what's inside of you and what it needs. And then you start to really start to wake up to the inner wisdom inside of you, get those answers inside of you, and be able to move through challenging emotions with a lot more awareness and consciousness.
That was beautiful.
Yeah. Super helpful. I've done RAIN more times than I can count.
I love that. I will use that. Thank you.
Yeah.
Wow. Very useful.
And I think it gives our minds, our logical minds, when they're in fear, it gives our minds a way to focus so that we're able to walk ourselves through whatever emotions are there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I love the idea of loving your shame, loving your guilt, loving your sadness, loving your fear, and allowing it.
They're messengers, right? These emotions are messengers. They're gifts. They're guides. They're letting us know what's going on inside of us mm-hmm. and where we need attention and what needs to shift inside of us. Oftentimes the shame is there because we're making ourselves wrong because of what we're experiencing, right? Mm-hmm. Shame is, I am wrong. I am wrong. I shouldn't be having this experience. This is wrong. I am wrong. And anytime we're believing that, we're creating that emotion of shame. And so once we go within and we do that inner work and we start to accept the experience that we're having, then the shame will start to dissolve. Otherwise, we can stay in that loop where we are thinking about shame. We're having this unconscious belief about ourselves, creating more of that emotion, and we can get into an unconscious loop with all of that. So it's like we start to get to know what needs to be released. We start to look at the limiting patterns within us that need our attention. And we start to become aware of what is going on so that we can start to flow our energy in a different way and start to believe things that align with our divine self, that align with the truth of life.
Yeah, I love that you are skilled at helping and guiding people toward that inner knowing. I think there are a lot of people who have difficulty attaching to that part of themselves or getting to know or meeting that part of themselves, and they're afraid to go there. And they do think back and think about their lives and think about the things they wished hadn't happened or the things they wish they hadn't done or experienced, but they stop there. They don't know how to take it to a place of healing. So what are some of the things people can do to help to feel better about those parts of their lives that they wish they could?
I think usually for the women that I work with and for the work that I've had to do, I had to really start looking at the parts of me that were afraid to go within and work with those protective parts first, right? I had a really strong protective, these were like, I would call them protective parts of my inner world that were trying to keep me from going within, because these parts believed that I was going to lose some kind of safety or security, or I would lose something if I went within, right? Mm-hmm. So I think all the parts inside of us have good intention. So I had a part of me that believed it was really selfish and silly to do inner work, that somehow this was a selfish thing to do and that it was proof that there was something wrong with me. So I had to really look at that part directly and, you know, rewire that within myself and say, no, if I don't go within, I'm going to create the wiser part of me. My heart and soul knew that wasn't true. So I was able to start working with that part and let that part know that wasn't true and create a trusting relationship with that part of myself. So that part would relax enough that I was able to go within and start to heal the inner child, because that part was actually trying to protect the inner child within, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. I also had another part that believed that feeling emotions or having emotions was very wrong and dangerous in some way. And that if I went within, I would trigger a release of emotions that would overwhelm me and that I wouldn't be safe. So I had to really work with that part of myself as well and let that part know again that it was safe, that I was there. Once you're more, I always say it's driving the bus, right? When you have all these inner children inside of you who have different fears and they're riding the bus, then it's going to cause a wreck. But if you, higher self you, adult you, this more evolved version of you, if you're the one driving the bus and all the kids are in the back, then it's going to be a much safer ride. So I had to really get all of these different parts of myself into the back of the bus so I could be the one driving the bus. But I had to do that with a lot of intention and with not shaming these different parts, because even the parts of me that were really self-destructive, the parts of me that were using alcohol and drugs to try to escape emotions, those parts believed that was keeping me safe because they believed if I felt any emotions that I would die. So these parts had good intentions. So once I understood that and I appreciated them and I was able to understand why these parts were driving me to do these things, then I was able to get to the deeper parts that needed to be healed. So it was like multi-layered inner child work, mm-hmm. and just meeting what was there and meeting the resistance that was there so that I was able to go within and really heal the part of me that felt so unsafe. Because once you do that, all these other parts, their the desire to do self-destructive things naturally went away when I was able to work with the part of me that felt so unsafe. So it was getting to know those different parts and getting to know, connecting with my true self, the self with a capital S, by listening to affirmations, by doing forgiveness work, by just being more present with what was there. Like the more I connected with my true self, the more all of these different inner children inside of me started to feel safe because I was there to drive the bus, as opposed to them having to be there driving the bus. So that's where I started, was starting to connect with the self more. And then as I did that, the parts of me that I needed to get to know and these different emotions, again, they're just there to be messengers. They started to show up so that I could meet them and get to know them so I could do this deeper work.
Yeah. I love that so much. Do you think the true self and the higher self are the same?
I do. I think it's just, I think of it as the self with a capital S, mm-hmm. which is just the soul self. The mm-hmm. I call it the part of us that's always in unconditional love, mm-hmm. right? The part of mm-hmm. us that has the bigger picture, the part of us that understands this earthly life that we are in, the part of us that is able to see it from a bigger picture, that wiser part of us that is always in us, always there. It's like the sun is always shining even when there's clouds, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. And so these other parts of us, these ego parts of us, cover up the sun, but the sun is always there. And so it's the natural self, right? This is who we are at our natural core. This is why true self is such a good name for it. Higher self, true self. So many different ways we can talk about it. Heart self, soul self, yeah. right? But it's all the same. It's yeah. the sun that is always shining, and we're naturally in that open-hearted, natural self at certain times of the day. Think about how you feel when you see a child who's having this like incredible free moment and they're like laughing. Like you go into that natural self with a lot of ease. And the women that I work with, they will naturally show up in their heart when someone else needs their help. They are givers. They are nurturers. If someone else was in pain, they would immediately get into that natural self to help them. Mm-hmm. And it's like learning how to do that for ourselves.
Oh, yeah.
And that's such, I actually tell the people that I work with, I'm like, you're naturally, and I work with so many nurses and so many teachers and so many healers and so many people who are naturally guided to share love in the world in whatever ways. And it's, this is your superpower. You just need to remind yourself to turn it on yourself, not mm-hmm. just to allow that to be for everybody else, but to shine mm-hmm. it on yourself. And that's often just a belief system inside that I should help everybody else and deplete myself, when the opposite is true. Of course, you want to learn how to give to yourself so that you give from that whole place.
Yeah. That reminds me of mothers, and especially mothers who are at the stage of life when maybe their children are no longer living at home and yeah. they don't know how to turn that love back on themselves at that stage of life.
That's when a lot of people actually start to awaken. That's when a lot of people start to ask deeper questions and ask, why am I not feeling fulfilled? What is going on inside of me? What needs healing inside of me? They may not ask those questions, but they might be at that point, if they end up in my world, like, why do I still struggle with food? And that will be the gateway into reaching deeper parts of yourself and starting to see life through a different point of view. So I always think that's like a beautiful time of awakening, a beautiful time to start doing this kind of inner work. Of course, any time is a good time. You have the time now to take care of yourself and to think about yourself. And that can be really uncomfortable at first. But once you work with that part of you that doesn't want to do the, and it feels uncomfortable with that, then it turns into this really fun and exciting journey of getting to know yourself and following your heart and following your own passions and believing that you're worthy enough to do so, remembering that you're worthy enough to do
so. Yeah. So people come to you thinking that they need help with their relationship with food, but they actually need to do the inner work.
Yeah. I always say it's like a soulful and practical. The women that end up in my world and end up in my classes, it's like their soul self is calling them to heal, to evolve, to release. And the relationship with food and body is just the doorway or the portal, which helps them to do. And that is a big enough pain point that it really is an awesome way to open and awaken, because we have a body and we can't run away from it. And we always have to eat at this point. We always have to eat food, right? We, all of us, have some sort of relationship with food. And so you really can't get away from it. So eventually it'll point you back to your own heart, to your own wisdom inside it.
Wow. So many wonderful nuggets there. I love it. I love this stuff. The food is such an interesting thing, because we have such a major, it's, besides other people, it's the thing we have probably have the closest relationship with in our lives, right?
Mm-hmm. And so, think about what a mirror it is for nurturing and nourishing ourselves. The last step of rain is to nourish and nurture ourselves. So our relationship with food is literally a direct relationship to our own ability to nurture and nourish ourselves. And so we don't know how to support ourselves and nurture ourselves mentally and emotionally and physically. Your relationship with food is a beautiful mirror to help you get to know how to grow that and how to really expand that and how to release any limiting patterns within you that tell you it's selfish to do that. Or a lot of us have these very broken relationships with our bodies. We don't believe that we can trust our bodies. We don't think that our bodies know what they're doing. We try and restrict food and we ignore our bodies when they actually tell us we need food. And so it's, as you develop a trusting relationship with your body and food, you're also developing a trusting relationship with life. So it's a really awesome mirror and journey to go on.
Yeah, absolutely. What's the role of intuition in all this?
Oh, it's huge. And I love that the intuitive eating movement has a lot of momentum these days. And I think that's a beautiful thing, because it's reminding everybody that this is intuitive, that we naturally know how to feed ourselves, that it shouldn't be so complicated. I think the problem that I see in the intuitive eating communities is a lot of people are doing the intuitive eating work before they've done the inner work and the belief work. And so if you have a deep subconscious belief that your body, that you can't trust the body that you have, and you try and go immediately into the intuitive eating part, you will just be blocked all the time. And so in my program, we do the inner work first, so that by the time we get to the intuitive eating part, that's happening naturally. Right. I think a lot of people try to eat intuitively, still using their minds to do it. And they're not really comfortable with their bodies. They don't have a trusting relationship with their bodies. They haven't dealt with the inner beliefs that may be in the way of them being able to tune into their intuition and let their bodies lead. So, for example, if you have an unconscious belief that it's not safe to be thin because of something that happened in your childhood, let's say that you were attacked or you were abused in some way, and you put the weight on as an unconscious way to stay safe, which is very common. Safety and weight is very connected. Then you may be learning how to eat intuitively, but there's a part of you, a subconscious part of your psyche, that doesn't believe it's safe for you to be at your healthy, natural weight. So that part of you is running the show, and that part of you needs to be healed before you're able to tune in and eat from an intuitive way. So really learning how to heal the different parts of ourselves is, I believe, the important step before trying to do the intuitive eating before you do the healing work, in my experience, can be a little confusing at times.
Mm-hmm. It's very complex. I love the way you're explaining it all. What do you think the ideal healthy body looks like? Is there an ideal?
I think the ideal is whatever, you know, I believe that our bodies are naturally always trying to bring us back into the weight and the state that's best going to serve us. So for example, when you go outside and it's cold outside, your body starts to shiver to bring your body back into the temperature, the internal temperature that will make you most comfortable and most able to enjoy this life. And so with weight, it's the same thing. Like, our bodies know, and I don't believe there's trying to get to one particular weight on the scale. There's like a healthy range that your body can exist in. And when you're in tune with your body, you will naturally, and animals in the wild, right? Like you rarely see animals in the wild. Their animal body knows the weight that they need to be at different times of the year. I'm just thinking of like a bear as they go into hibernation right now, right? So it's, that's a very natural thing. And our animal bodies are the same. Our bodies know the weight that is going to most serve us. And when we are letting our bodies lead, you will be in a weight and relax into a weight that is going to feel best for you. And that's the weight where you're able to enjoy life and enjoy food and feel comfortable and be able to walk outside and feel good. I don't think there's, what was the question? What's the ideal weight?
Or the ideal body? What does the ideal healthy body look like?
I think the ideal healthy body is the one that intuitively feels good to you. You're at the weight that feels good to you. You're able to enjoy life and enjoy food. That is going to be different for each of us.
Yeah.
But it's going to be, it's about a feeling. It's like a natural intuitive feeling that you have.
Yeah.
Yeah. Whereas I had a set number in my head that I was always trying to get to on the scale and always like getting on the scale and letting the scale determine my worth. And that weight that I was trying to get to is much lower than the weight that I've been at for the past 20 years, right? It's like my body now is at the size that it feels most comfortable in, but that's different. Not necessarily the size that our mind is trying to get us to based on some external idea that we may have. As you do the inner work, release the beliefs, become more in tune and form a trusting relationship with your body, you will settle into the size that feels most natural, intuitive, and free for you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So when the mind is healthy.
Yeah. When the mind is healthy, when this part of your mind that is most of us have a very critical part that believes that once we get to a certain size on the scale, our life is going to magically be amazing once we are at that certain size on the scale where everything's going to be amazing. But what people discover, if they have enough willpower to be on a very restrictive diet and get down to that size, they get to that size and they feel the exact same way they felt before. Mm-hmm. They'll discover that everything they haven't dealt with is still there. And that's why it's really, my program is called Feel Better, Eat Better, because again, it's about the feeling. And as you start to embody the feelings that you want to feel now, you'll discover that you can feel good no matter what size you're at and enjoy the journey and really realize it is about so much more than just the number on the scale. And then when you lose the weight from that point of view, you keep it off forever because you have this much broader soulful point of view.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's beautiful. Can you tell us what happened to your dad?
What happened to my dad?
Yeah.
What happened? Yeah. So he, as I mentioned, was very overweight during our childhood, 100 plus pounds overweight. He had his first heart attack when he was 56. And then from 56 until he died at, I think, 76, he had maybe 30 additional heart attacks. He had diabetes, he had cancer, he had every weight-related disease you can imagine. And he had a very difficult, the last 20 years of his life, he was in and out of hospitals, incredibly uncomfortable. And I really watched him. It was a very painful life, the last 20 years of his life. And unfortunately, he died very unhappy and very uncomfortable. And that's what happened to him.
Is there anything you wish you could say to him?
No, I had a lot of conversations with him. I believe that we can actually have higher self to higher self conversations with people, whether they're alive or dead. Like we all have a higher self. We all have a soul self. And so I was having conversations with his higher self even before he passed away, understanding his journey from a higher self perspective, because while on the human level, that looks incredibly devastating and incredibly hard to witness on the human level. And I was in the hospital with him a lot of the times, I was living on the West Coast for some of those years, but I've spent enough time with him in the hospital and done enough inner work that I really wanted to understand his journey from a soul level. And I learned to see his journey, even though on the human level, it looks really hard. I know on the soul level, there's so much that he was growing and learning through that experience. And I trust in that larger divine plan. And I know that if he was having that experience, there were reasons on the soul level for it, reasons beyond what my mind can understand at this point. So I'm at peace with it. That being said, it definitely is an inspiration to share the work that I do and to continue the inner work that I do, because the journey doesn't have to be that painful if you are willing to look within and start to do this kind of inner work. And so we can create a lot more ease in that journey with ourselves if we choose to.
Yeah. Do you believe that we enter these physical bodies with an assignment that's already determined?
I believe that we come in with intentions of things that we want to heal and things that we want to share. I think they're much broader and wider. For example, I want to grow in self-compassion, or I want to learn how to trust, or I want to heal betrayal, right? I think they're much larger intentions. And I think there's so many different ways that those can play out. But I do think that we come in with soul intentions.
Yeah. I do too. Is there anything you fear these days?
Anything that I fear? Yeah, of course. Maybe not reaching my own potential, right? Sharing what I've shared online and even being able to do this kind of podcast, I had a lot of fears of being persecuted, a lot of fears of being punished for sharing, a lot of fears that these ideas that are just a little bit outside the mainstream ideas about food and weight, the energy and the self-love and all of this, it took a fair amount of me doing my own inner work to be able to share, speaking for sharing, literally stuttering my whole life. And now I share and then I speaking and sharing these ideas is what I do now. So I've had to do a lot of my own internal work to feel safe enough to share these ideas. And so I just want to keep having the courage and keep doing. I can't how many times I've wanted to quit my whole business and be like, okay, I'm done. Because there's so many different things growing a business as well that you have to work through, and so many things technology wise, and so many things that you have to learn about growing a business, and also finding a way to market my business in a way that felt good to my heart. There's a lot of ego marketing tactics out there, even in businesses that are supposed to be more spiritual. I find there's still a lot of that there. So finding ways to grow my business that feel good to me. I'm so blessed that I formed a partnership with Gina and Skinny Taste many years ago. We have 7 New York Times bestselling cookbooks now, and that sort of being a part of her world, her brand is huge, gives me the opportunity to share these ideas with people that are ready to hear them. So just trusting that the universe is wanting to support me in this, and just doing my own inner work to believe, number one, that I'm doing enough. There used to be a part of me that would feel guilty that I hadn't done more or shared more or expanded more, that kind of thing. Just trusting where my journey is now and allowing that to unfold with more ease. And just wanting to... Louise Hay died at 94, and she died in her sleep exactly the way that she wanted to. Wanting to create that kind of ease with aging and the death process, wanting to have a death process that is, I'd rather be healthy. I'd rather not leave this planet the way that my dad did. So continuing to do my inner work and continuing to whatever health issues or whatever issues come up in my life, use those to help me to grow so I'm able to create the rest of my life and pass away in a way that has a lot more peace than I would say used to the planet. Going into the memory care home where my mother is and just noticing the way that a lot of us are conditioned into this belief that as we age and that there's a certain path that your body is going to take. And I would like to create something different than that.
Me too.
Yeah.
So what are your biggest lessons in life that you've learned?
Biggest lessons in life. Definitely that everything is happening for me and through me instead of things are happening to me, getting out of that victim mindset and getting into that creator mindset and really using everything in my life to know myself and to love myself. So I'd say that was the biggest lesson overall, that whatever's happening, there's a reason for it. And that if I choose to lean into that and choose to know there's meaning and purpose and value in all of it, then I'm able to see it through that soul point of view. And to know that the challenges in my life, including my speech and my relationship with food and everything I've gone through with my parents, that those are the things that have helped me to grow the most. And so to see them through the lens of love and to see that there are good reasons for those things as well.
Yes, that's a huge lesson for people.
And that it's safe to feel my emotions, right? Like understanding my emotions has been a huge lesson for me, not pushing my emotions away, really understanding my emotions, allowing my emotions to be there, becoming, letting my emotions be my guide and understanding that, yeah, that it's safe to feel. Yes.
What about your blessings? What are the things you're most grateful for?
Oh my gosh, I'm so grateful for the life I have now and for the life I've created now. I'm so grateful that I get to share this information. So grateful for the friendships and partnerships I have, like with Gina from Skinny Taste. Gina Homolka is the creator of that brand. And we have such a beautiful, loving relationship that helps me to reach the people that are ready to walk this path with me. So I'm grateful for my relationships. I'm grateful for the things I've grown through. And I'm just so grateful to see, again, like how the healing in the world is just expanding and people are awakening and there are more and more people being called to this path. And that makes me grateful and excited as well.
Yeah, I love that. So if people are interested in working with you, how can they reach you?
Yeah, you can go to my website, heatherkjones.com. And I have lots of free resources there. I do free coaching inside my Facebook group 2 times a month. That's a really good place to get to know me and feel if I'm a good fit for you. And I have a masterclass that sort of walks through the 7 soulful steps to create a healthier relationship with food, your body, and yourself. That would be a really great place to start as well. I offer free exercises in there, and it just guides you through the 7 steps that I had to walk through in my own life and that I've shared with over, I think I've worked with over 3,000 clients inside my programs at this point. And you'll also see, I have so many women who share testimonials, who share their experiences and have really vaulted themselves into new, just their lives have changed in all these beautiful ways. Because as you really put your focus on your relationship with yourself, as you create a more loving and respectful and kind relationship with yourself, you will find that it changes so many different parts of your life in so many amazing ways. Like it changes everything. So you'll see lots of examples of people who have taken that path and who are starting to heal and awaken and use their relationship with food and body to really grow and evolve themselves.
Oh, how beautiful. And the Skinny Taste books are available where?
Oh, Skinny Taste books are available everywhere. They are New York Times best-selling books. Skinny Taste Simple is the most recent book. And what's beautiful about her food is that it's really whole natural foods cooked in a really beautiful, easy way. Anybody can. The reason her brand, I believe, has grown so much is because, number one, she cooks with a lot of love. There's so much heart into the food that she creates. And I think that is shared throughout these books. And it really helps you to start to have a beautiful relationship with food and success in the kitchen, learning how to fuel yourself and nourish yourself from just an easy way. Because her recipes, they're like foolproof. They always work. They're easy to cook and they're amazing.
That's so great. Wow. Yeah. Thank you so much, Heather, for joining me and for being so vulnerable and sweet and kind and intelligent, and just all of your heart just came through so strongly in this talk. I loved talking with you.
Oh, thank you so much. I loved being here. You're wonderful to speak to. These are the best kind of talk.
If you've gotten to the end of this episode, I know that you are one of my loyal listeners, and you probably already know this, but the impact of other people's stories in our lives is profound and powerful. And I want to read you some feedback that I got from Dash, whose story I shared at the beginning of season 2. He received this note and he shared it with me. Hi, Dash. We met years ago in Santa Fe when you treated me to a wonderful lunch. I just finished listening to your interview on Blessings and I had to reach out. My mixed feelings right now include inspiration, joy, and a deep gratitude to you for sharing your incredible life and its lessons. I also feel a sadness that I did not get to know you better when I was in Santa Fe. You embody grace and a loving humor that I imagine enfolds everyone you meet. And boy, what an exciting life. I'm actually getting choked up reading that, because when I get feedback like this, it's hard for me to even describe the feelings that come up. It's a mixture of happiness, pride, and tremendous gratitude. It keeps me going. But most of all, it reminds me that I am putting something meaningful out there into the world, something that the world needs. So thank you to all of my listeners and to all of the people who have blessed me with their stories. I know that I'm doing the right thing. Thank you for keeping me on track.